Hello and welcome to Bowery Poetry Speaks, an audio series of talks and performances from our special Bowery perspective. At Bowery, we start every event with an Honor Native Land statement. We would like to acknowledge that Bowery Poetry Club rests on the traditional lands and waters of the Lenape people, and we give respect to the Lenape and their elders past, present, and future by speaking in the Lenape language, Anushik, which means thank you and welcome. Anushik.
In this episode, host Joe Williams speaks with translator Richard Dixon about Italian author Antonio Moresco's Clandestinity.
Hello, welcome to Traffic Europe Radio. I'm your host, Joe Williams, and today my guest in the studio is translator from Italian, Richard Dixon, and we'll be focusing mainly on his translation, on his work translating seminal Italian modernist author Antonio Moresco, particularly his recent short story collection, Clandestinity, which is recently published by Deep Vellum. And available now. First of all, I'd like to ask Richard if he could introduce himself to the listeners. I noticed on your website, Richard, your CV of the writers that you've worked with kind of reads like who's who of modernist Italian literature. You've got Roberto Calasso, Antonio Moresco, of course, Umberto Eco. Could you tell us more about yourself? What's your relationship with translation? How did you come to be based in Italy and translating Italian modernist literature?
Yeah, it's a long story. But I used to be a lawyer, and then I thought better of it and moved to Italy and started translating anything. Really, because my knowledge of Italian was not very good, I started off doing the obvious thing, which was translating legal texts. And then all and everything from tour guides to manuals for all sorts of things from washing machines and all the rest. And then I was very lucky. All the best things in life happen by chance. To meet somebody who was involved in a project for the translation of Leopardi's great work, the Zibaldone. And I found myself invited to take part with six other translators in this enormous project, 2,400 pages, of Leopardi's philosophical thoughts under the auspices of University of Birmingham and Rome. It led me on to Umberto Eco. I translated the last five books of his life. He sadly died a few years ago. I was also invited to translate Roberto Calasso, who also sadly died last year. Other things, Stefano Massini, the Lehman Trilogy, which was put on stage. I did the novel Carlo Emilio Gadda, Volponi, and other modern authors.
Yeah, thank you so much for that introduction. And it's a quite impressive resume you've got as a translator. And I can definitely identify with some of the things that you're saying, because I'm also a translator. And obviously, my ambition, my preference would be to work a lot more with literary text. But as you say, it requires a lot of fortune to break into that world. It's quite insular and guarded at times, especially in certain cultures. So I translate general texts, I translate marketing texts, academic texts, and little bits of literature here and there. So yeah, it gives me some hope, at least, that maybe one day I'll translate Fernando Pessoa or somebody like this. You've definitely mentioned some crucial Italian authors there. And how about Antonio Moresco? What was the nature of your first interaction with his writing? Was this somebody that you'd read before, or was this something that you came to as a professional translator seeking to translate, or were you just simply a reader when you first read his work? Well,
I met Antonio Moresco about 15 years ago at, I think it was a presentation of one of his books, either that or it was at a conference on modern literature. I can't remember now, but it was about 2004. It was a smallish gathering of people. We met afterwards, had dinner together, and I began reading his books. Clandestinity was certainly one of the early books I read. And then I read another book called La Lucina, which I decided I wanted to translate. And that was translated by Archipelago Books in, I think, 2016. Did quite well. It was shortlisted for the American Literary Translation Association Award a few years ago, and also for the International Dublin Award. And then I was asked to do this collection of short stories. They're in fact, they include the title story, which was the first thing that Antonio Moresco ever wrote, which was back in 1969. Before that, he was already in his 30s. He'd been working, doing odd jobs in all sorts of places, from factories to night portering to building worker and porter. And he then began to start writing seriously. So that was the first of his stories. And that began a whole career, which has now, I think, reached 20 books or so.
Yeah, I recognize the titles of some of those books you mentioned. La Lucita, one of the books was translated into Spanish as La Lucita, The Little Light. So yeah, Clandestinity then, this is the book that you've most recently translated and published, available from Deep Vellum. So it's quite an interesting book. It consists of some ostensibly not connected short stories. It's a collection of stories which were written at different points. They come from chronologically, they're not from the same period, but they do relate to each other and connect to each other in some quite interesting ways. Perhaps you could introduce the book to our listeners who may not be familiar with Moresco and with this book in particular. Could you explain a little bit about the book itself, Clandestinity, and the form and the tone and the whole kind of underlying concept?
Yes. It was, Esco describes, as a collection of one short novel and three long stories. It's about 200 pages long. He wrote them over a span of 26 years. The first one was written in 1979 and the last one in 2012. So there's a large space of time over which they were written. They do seem to be interlinked. And in fact, in his opening note, Moresco talks about this. He says they seem to have the same character who goes through all four stories. In three of the stories, as a young boy, and in the fourth story, as a young man. It's difficult to tell whether it's the same person. Perhaps it doesn't matter. The curious thing is that all of these stories, although he says they are highly autobiographical, seem to have a fairy tale feel to them. There's no indication of time or place. We guess that this is Italy, but there are no place names. We can guess that the first stories were probably set in the 1950s or 60s. There's a suggestion, mention of an installation of a telephone, a motor car in the garage, which didn't have proper wheels, but was fitted with aircraft wheels because they could be found cheaply. So we assume that we're talking about post-war Italy. But it doesn't matter. These are stories that really have no solid setting in time or place. They're hard-punching stories because although you might call them fairy tales, the imagery is very powerful, very strong, but yet the setting itself is almost quaint. Two of the stories, The Blue Room and The King, are set in a large decaying city mansion where Moresco says that he in fact spent his childhood. One of the other inhabitants of this mansion is an elderly woman called, in both of the stories, in The Blue Room and in The King, is referred to as La Signorina. And Moresco explains that this was a real person as well, who was an elderly countess who was blind and bedridden with arthritis. And they nicknamed her the Signorina because she had a childlike manner. He remembers her as being rather kind and a rather innocent person, but she was deformed and couldn't live a normal life. The other two stories are set in very different settings, but again, they're autobiographical in terms of the detail of the setting. One of the other two short stories is called The Hole, and it's set in a cottage and garden, which was in fact, Moresco says, the cottage that his father and grandfather had built using river stone. The hole itself that gives the story its name was the cesspit in the outhouse toilet, which became a focal point for the young boy's fascination and his revulsion because all kinds of garbage and oddments were tipped in there. And this outhouse becomes transformed into a sort of a world of make-believe, but it was also a place where the boy could be private and alone. Here in this particular short story, there's an undercurrent of isolation, certainly, but there's also the feeling of death hanging over the story. We're told in the first pages that the boy's mother had just recently died in childbirth. The baby brother is upstairs being tended by a wet nurse. And again, there's a peculiarly fairy tale quality to the story. We don't quite know when it's set. There are carts going backwards and forwards in the lane outside, being pulled by horses. But at the same time, there's a reference to an automobile. So it's clearly post-war rural Italy. The fourth story, which is the title story, so it's not really the fourth story at all. It was first in time of being written, and in fact, in this collection, it's the third, is the most disturbing of all the stories. It was written in early 1979 when Moresco was living in a one-room apartment with his wife and young daughter, working during the day. In every moment time he had off, he was writing in the railway station waiting room. He was writing at night, sitting on the seat of the toilet in the bathroom. And these are the seeing around him as he was writing his story. It's the most violent and shocking of the three stories. It's the most sexually explicit. And yet it's told with a disarming detachment, as if somehow the narrator was a mere witness, as if it was a violence which was out of his control that he was powerless to stop. He had this to say when I spoke to him a few days ago. I made a note. He said, "Clandestinity is my first book where I'm feeling my way in the darkness, looking for a way out, for a path as a man and as a writer. The idea that we are surrounded by darkness and have to face the darkness is something that never leaves me. Our lives do not follow a clear straight line, but have aspects that cannot be explained." And I think this idea of darkness, and he also referred in the same conversation to innocence. The innocence of the child is a very powerful image in his novels, in his short stories, in everything he's written. The children are the innocent ones. The animals are the innocent ones. The narrator often has a very powerful relationship with animals around who have been either mistreated or their destiny is to end up being slaughtered and served for humans. And so adults get a rough deal in Moresco's right. And a lot of the darkness is expressed in very shocking terms, in pornographic detail, in violence, which if you meet the man, if you meet Moresco in social circumstance, the two things almost don't fit together. He's quiet, almost monastic in appearance and his demeanor. He's a quietly spoken man, politically committed, with a profound social conscience. And then the writing that you read sometimes is really very difficult to stomach. He's even said it, that his aim in writing some of his stories is to give his reader a punch in the stomach. He succeeds. Some of it is very hard.
Great. Thank you so much. There's a lot here that I'd like to return to later, especially the kind of influence of folklore on the writing, or fairy tales, as you've expressed it, the dreamlike kind of enigmatic quality to some of the writing, and also the elements of the grotesque. These all come across very strongly in the book. Before we have a more conversation about that, though, maybe it'd be good to hear a reading from the book so listeners can hear how this works out in practice. So I understand you prepared some readings. Is that correct?
I thought I'd just read a little bit. From the beginning of The Blue Room, we're introduced into this villa, and a lot of the architectural detail is written down in very considerable detail. This old mansion, now somewhat dilapidated, which you arrive at either through the courtyard, up some back steps into the kitchen, which is closed with a flimsy wooden door and no lock, or the main entrance, which is reached from a great double stairway and a fake marble banister, takes you through to a large room, to the entrance lobby, and on to other rooms. And here in this story, we're introduced to the young boy, who we follow all the way through, the main character. and we follow him through into the Blue Room, from which the story takes its name. And here's just a short passage. It was dark inside, as the windows were nearly always shut, and an old dark blue wallpaper, slightly torn here and there, covered all the walls. A blind old lady lived there. Everyone in the house called her the Signorina. He approached her bed in silence, gazed at her wide open eyes that looked like globes of plastic, caught her murmuring a prayer, her hair very long, thick, and jet black despite her age, flowing inexplicably from that small bony head, went to form an intricate mass on the pillow. The Signorina turned two or three times in the bed, murmured something else, then went back to sleep with her hands together on the fold of the sheet. He often stared at those hands. They were long and light, almost weightless. Arthritis had produced two lumps, one on the wrist and the other on the last bones of the fingers, deforming them. They looked like the stylized image of a wing in flight. Before supper, the Signorina got out of bed and shuffled to the kitchen. When she returned to the Blue Room, her hands feeling for the doors, he ran noiselessly behind her, passing with her through the empty rooms, the anteroom, the dining hall, which had a small revolving hatch in one wall, once used to serve dishes without any need to enter the hall. When he was very small, he could get inside the rotating mechanism and was able in that way to move from one room to the other, or was whirled around inside it, propelled by unknown hands, who stopped the carousel only after he'd shouted out and banged his little fists inside the wooden cylinder to get them to stop. He waited for the Signorina to get back in bed, then sat in a corner with schoolbooks on his knees. And then it continues, we're told about his schoolbooks. A rather curious detail in this story is that I think one of the themes in this story is loneliness, this boy by himself with the only company is the Signorina. It's about adolescence, sexual curiosity. It's also about fear, but it's also about poetic awakening. And so through this story, Moresco very cleverly weaves quotes from Homer's Iliad, from Herodotus, Shakespeare, Goethe, Dostoevsky, Darwin, and from the books that the boy is reading, quotes he's writing down on pieces of paper. With some writers, the effect might have been heavy and pretentious, but here they seem to fit quite naturally into the story. You said that you've read it yourself, and I think it's interesting to notice also that during the story there are three parts, there are three viewpoints, because the first part is written in the third person. So we see the boy from, if you like, from above, from outside. And then the second part is the boy's diary that he's writing on bits of paper. And then the third part, the third section, is told by the boy who returns years later and finds the diary he'd been writing on those bits of paper. And that's the interesting moment when you begin to realize that this story actually has got something missing, because in the third section, the older grown-up boy says there are so many things were missing in those accounts that we'd read before. Details far more important. And we don't know, the reader doesn't know, but this other companion story, which is called The King, which is a very different story, which is the fourth of the short stories, is also set in the same place. And as we read that fourth story, at least I, as a reader, I've no idea, because I haven't specifically asked Moresco this question, gets the feeling perhaps that the contents of this other short story are actually what we hadn't been told in the first short story. So he's playing a game with us.
Sure, absolutely. So sticking with the Blue Room, first of all, yeah, I think what you said is very true. I think there's a certain childlike innocence on the part of the narrator and his fascination, his curiosity with the human body and how it functions. And human bodies, they're not idealized in any way in the book. The descriptions of human bodies and their functions are not at all flattering or romantic or idealized. So there's a certain kind of harshness in the way that he describes descriptions of physical bodies. And also there's a very kind of frail...
The signorina.
But yeah, she's very frail. Yes. She's very frail, and the narrator actually observes her in her most intimate and vulnerable moments, totally uninvited and unbeknownst to her. But he always comes across as just very innocent and childlike. So the childlike fascination with bodies and sexual awakening and functioning of bodies is something which I think the book deals with in quite an oblique, kind of elliptical sort of way. Like I said, there's a certain enigmatic sort of quality to some of these where things are not really, it doesn't really feel particularly resolved. So I suppose that would lead me on to the next point I wanted to make, which was in the author's note, and as you've talked about already, Sko has retroactively, it seems, looked back at these stories and decided they all seem to treat the same character or a different version of the same character at a different stage in that character's life. I get the sense that this was not his intention when he was writing these stories, and this seems to be something that he's inferred after the fact, that he's perhaps dealing with some subconscious urges and some subconscious impulses, which I think is something else that the book seems to deal with, is the subconscious. It's got this very ethereal, surrealist, dreamlike quality. So what's your take on this? Do you think it was something that he's decided, looking back at these stories, that this is the same character at different moments in time? Or do you think it was something more conscious and more ended?
I think my take is that Moresco is an obsessive writer. He's a true writer who, for him, writing is the only thing that matters in life. And so he writes every day, and he writes, and he writes. And I think one should say, between these four short stories, he had also written a three-volume trilogy, a massive, monumental work, which is called The Games of Eternity. And I think that he writes, and while he was writing The Games of Eternity, other books were coming out off it, or almost like spin-offs. So I've got a feeling that these four short stories should not be seen in isolation, but part of a much bigger thing, so that the other book that I've translated, La Lucina, which is translated as The Distant Light, in many ways, The Boy in Distant Light, and also because there are two characters there's a boy and an older man. In many ways, you can see parts of both of those characters in the earlier short stories. You can see them in his other writings as well. So I think it's very difficult to say. I think he just writes and things come out and he develops things and he realizes, actually, as with Distant Light, he realized this story I'm telling here doesn't fit into my big monumental trilogy. It's actually developing a life of its own. I think a lot of these stories develop lives of their own. We've fitted them together for publishing purposes, but I think it's too easy to try and see them in isolation away from everything else. I think they have to be fitted into a much bigger context of the other work that Moresco is doing, and also the other way in which his writing is developing, which, I mean, the most recent of these stories were 10 years ago. He's been writing and writing ever since. So to try and fit these four together, I think, is a bit too easy. There's a lot that joins them together, but there's a lot that's not there, which you'll find elsewhere.
Great. Yeah, fascinating. Another aspect which I wanted to talk about, we've talked about the fairy tale aspect to it, which I also agree is very prominent and foregrounded, especially the grotesque elements. Like you've talked about, there's a lot of quite unappetizing situations and events in the stories. There's violence, there's things that might make you feel quite queasy, and this reminds me of perhaps certain kinds of fairy tales and folklore, which could be quite grotesque and quite horrific. But I'm also interested in the way that kind of political and social context and realities inform folk folklore and oral traditions and this kind of thing. And I was very interested to hear you say earlier on in your introduction that Moresco is very politically and socially committed and conscious. But do you see that there's political or social subtext in any of these stories, despite the fact that they seem quite disconnected from any reality with which we can identify? Do you think there is any political, social content or critique or commentary or subtext in any of these stories? Do you think that the political and social realities in any way inform any of this writing?
I think it's very difficult to arrive at any kind of interpretation. I think the stories stand up by themselves, and I don't feel able to make any particular judgment about political, this means that, or whatever, anything like that. Certainly the fairy tale vision is very powerful, and this is something which, in fact, I made a note because I was talking to him the other day, and he said this, because he sees this is important. He said, as a writer, I am fascinated by the simple and extreme vision of the fairy tale. I think folk tales have a clear and symbolic influence on the vast majority of great works. And then he names a whole list. And it's interesting what he names, what books he names. Starts off with the Odyssey, the Divine Comedy, Gargantua Pantagruel, Don Quixote, Gulliver's Travels, Moby Dick, Scarlet Letter, War and Peace, Crime and Punishment, works of Shakespeare, Jane Austen, Dickens, Kafka, and then also modern novels, which he sees as linked still to this vision of the fairy tale, The Great Gatsby, Light in August, Old Man and the Sea, and of course The Master and Margarita, and 100 Years in Solitude. And he ended up by saying the true radical fairy tale never distances itself from reality, but makes it possible to go deeper into its atomic heart. And I think that's what he's doing. He's always diving, digging down into reality to a point where you reach the absurd. And that's never going to be flattering. His pictures of people are never going to be flattering. He's going to always be trying to find the elemental vision of what we really are. And I think through his works, Giacomo Leopardi had this very strong vision that childhood was the only time when human beings can be truly happy. From that moment onwards, they become corrupted by all around them. And I think corruption is a very big part of what he's writing about, certainly in the behavior of the adult characters in his novels.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, interesting to hear Moresco talk about the symbolic aspects and meanings of folk tales, fairy tales, and this kind of thing, which, of course, is always a really fascinating area of study, isn't it? Recurring symbols and motifs and in oral traditions, and, of course, there can be no definitive interpretation on their meaning and what they represent. Turning now to the translation process, I'd be interested to talk to you about your process of translating Moresco and perhaps just more generally as a translator, starting more specifically with Clandestinity. Were there any interesting translation challenges which arose while you were translating this book, either linguistically or culturally or in any other category? What really forced you to work and apply your creative skills as a translator while working on this book?
I think it was important to try and capture Moresco's style, which I see as telling things as they are, without trying to varnish life, without trying to flatter, without his language, his prose is straight. It's not overly poetic. It can sometimes end up as then I did this, then I did that, and in this room and then in that room. But within that, he is creating a whole world because he's describing in such incredible detail human behavior, the architecture he sees around him, a peculiar foible of a particular person, captures a little scene in which something happens and he gets it down on paper in a way which I find totally original. It's very difficult to find a word, a sentence, a paragraph of Moresco, which is cliche. You don't find it. There's always something there which makes you sit up and makes you want to read the next chapter. I think the challenge of the translator there was, it was actually being loyal to that original simplicity, I'm going to say, but actually it's a simplicity which is quite difficult to capture sometimes in another language. Some of the simplest sentences in one language are really hard to translate into another language and to make sound as simple as they did in the first language. And I think that's often the challenge in this sort of thing. The other thing is dialogue. His dialogue is very straightforward. There's not much dialogue in the short stories. In Distant Light, there's more dialogue between the man and the boy. Just briefly, the man is in an isolated house in an isolated village, which has been deserted, sees a light on the other side of the valley, goes to investigate, and finds this spectral vision of a boy who's living alone in a house on the other side of the valley, seemingly perfectly able to cope by himself. And there's this conversation between the two people, which goes on through various chapters of the book. And the simplicity of their language was sometimes the thing I found most difficult to get right, because it had to sound natural, it had to sound right, it had to sound simple in English.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. Simple prose can actually present far more challenges than you might anticipate when you're reading it. When you actually try and reproduce that and render that into a different language, it can be surprisingly challenging. We're almost finished here, I think. Did you have another reading? Did you say you'd prepared two readings?
I'd prepared another reading, but yes, I have. It's curious because I mentioned that there were two short stories set in the same mansion. They seem to fit together. One seems to explain something that's missing from the other. And I was going to read just the opening of the second short story, because you've somehow, when you've read The Blue Room, you think you've already been there when you read these opening paragraphs of the other short story. And so I'll just read this and then I'll have a few words of comment. I was so small then that I had to stand on my tiptoes to see things. I wandered about inside a grand house full of skylights, fireplaces, steps, stairways, coats of arms. I looked out of a window, looked down at the bustling courtyard. Two other houses overlooked the same courtyard, where many nobles went about on foot or motor scooter, or sometimes even on horseback, stiffly, on certain special occasions when nobles who lived in other cities came to visit them. They came out all together into the courtyard, dressed in ceremonial clothes, brought out from the black chests on the stairways, and I also used to see a little boy my own age, with whom I had just been playing in the mud, as he too walked about in his little tailcoat, stiffly pale-faced. The horse too was brought out from the stable inside the hen house. A nobleman, in ceremonial dress, would climb onto it. From up there, he carried on talking to others below who walked alongside, while the horse lifted its tail and let its pat drop to the ground. Once I'd even seen the little boy of my age on it, put there by his father so that he would learn to sit on a saddle while he was still young. The boy refused to open his eyes because he was frightened up there, while the horse moved about at walking pace around the yard. He cried and shouted, "Papa, let me down." And his mother, Donna Parisi, went to the window of her room and told her husband to put the child down. But Conte Sauro said no, he had to learn. Children had to be put up there while they were still young, like his father had done to him, that nobles had to ride horses. And it goes on. And so you've got the same courtyard that you'd read about in the first story. It's evidently the same villa, because you get more detail later. But you're seeing a completely different picture, a different story. And then the story, which is quite comic at the beginning, takes an unexpected shift in an unexpected direction and heads towards a grotesque and totally unexpected ending, which I'm certainly not going to spoil by telling you what that is. But again, you've got two stories which seem to be together, which seem to fit together, where one seems to be finishing off another. But in fact, the whole of the effect of these stories is quite disarming. Here you are thinking this sounds like 18th century somewhere, possibly Italy, somewhere else. And then in the courtyard, you've got a motor scooter that appears. And there's a whole sort of you're taken back because nothing seems quite to fit. And this is what I think Moresco is a master at, putting things together, which is always making you sit up and pulling the rug from beneath your feet. Sometimes comically, sometimes horrifically, sometimes pornographically. And with Moresco, you have to be prepared for absolutely anything.
Thank you very much for sharing all your thoughts on Moresco and Clandestinity, which is available now on Deep Vellum, translated by my guest today, Richard Dixon. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to Richard Dixon about his translation of Italian author Antonio Moresco's Clandestine, available now from Deep Vellum Publishing. You've been listening to Bowery Poetry Speaks, an audio series of talks and performances with that special Bowery perspective. This series is executive produced by Traffica Europe Radio. Thanks for listening.